Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to a Bookworm retrospective of Kazuo Ishiguro, the 2017 Nobel Laureate in Literature.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
This is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Kazuo Ishiguro, the 2017 Nobel Prize Laureate for Literature. We've been digging into the Bookworm archive, and today we'll be showcasing excerpts from 25 years of Bookworm conversations with Mr. Ishiguro. In 1990, we discussed his Booker Prize-winning novel, The Remains of the Day.
The novel is about a butler in the days after the fall of the English butler, ruminating about his service for Lord Darlington and about the kind of world that has produced him and now to some extent ejected him. This book is also about love in a sense, and in some way the unexpressed love for Miss Kenton, what is her post?
She's a housekeeper.
Yes.
Well, she was a housekeeper.
And he's thought of her for many, many years after she's left the house, has tried to think of some way to bring her back, and now he thinks he's found one. His unexpressed love for Miss Darlington mirrors perhaps his inexpressible love or devotion to Lord Darlington. It's as if the greatest passions, such as they are, that sort of mirror each other in their silence. And so this is a book where great amounts of comedy as well as passion get expressed off stage, as it were. How do you express an inexpressible love as a writer?
Well, I guess by trying to portray all the tensions surrounding the lack of expression. And the portrait of Stevens in this book is, a lot of it is just that. It's about a man who, for some reason, has forbidden himself to love. But there's still a very, very strong force in him that demands that he remain a human being despite all his best efforts to turn himself into something else, in fact into the perfect butler, which by his definition is less than human. This book takes place during a few days during which Stevens takes a very rare holiday, and suddenly there's time to think and time to feel and time to reflect back over his life, and this very painful idea comes over him that he has wasted his life and that he has wasted his life in various ways, but in one key respect he has not seen through that emotion, that side of him that was capable of love.
The last thing one would expect of a book like this is that it would also be in a way a political book, and yet this human's nature reflects and in its tiny way impinges on political actualities. Lord Darlington, for different reasons, eventually becomes a Nazi sympathizer, and his butler believes enough in Lord Darlington to be willing to think that if perhaps Lord Darlington may or may not be right, but since it is Lord Darlington, Lord Darlington is right. Is the political sense of the book its base or subordinate in some sense to it?
Certainly when I was planning the book, it was a very fundamental part of the structure. In fact, one of the reasons I decided to write through a character of a butler was because that provided me with a key metaphor. And that metaphor was this, that I wanted to say something about the relationship of the small, ordinary person to political power. And I suppose in some sort of way I was suggesting that there is something of the butler in most of us. We do not usually get a chance to run governments or lead coup d'etats. Most of us just learn to do a small, rather peripheral thing well. And then we offer up our little contribution to some cause or organization or employer and hope for the best, that our little contribution is used in a way that we would approve of. But often we just do not know. The political and moral responsibility is usually held somewhere else. And we just sort of tap into some system and hope that our life and our life's work will look okay when we look at it from a wider perspective. And that's really the position Stevens adopts. He says, and I think it's a very dangerous one politically, but he says, look, I'm just a butler. I don't understand about world economics and diplomacy and military strategy. I'm just a butler. And the only way someone like me can contribute to great affairs is really to just serve a great man who does know. But of course, unfortunately for him, he trusts in the wrong man. He trusts in the man who ends up collaborating with the Nazis.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and today we're hearing excerpts of conversations with Nobel Prize laureate Kazuo Ishiguro. In 2000, I spoke with him about his novel When We Were Orphans. Its protagonist is a successful London detective. His childhood was spent in the Shanghai International Settlement in China. I thought that it would be interesting to take a representative passage from toward the beginning of the book and talk about its ramifications as it goes along. So I'm going to ask Mr. Ishiguro to read a section in which he describes what happens apparently, when the narrator's childhood friend, Akira, ventures outside the international settlement in Shanghai. Neither child is allowed to go outside the perimeters of the international settlement. Akira is Japanese, Christopher is English, and this is the description in childhood of their play.
It is slightly surprising to me, looking back today, to think how, as young boys, we were allowed to come and go unsupervised to the extent that we were. But this was, of course, all within the relative safety of the international settlement. I, for one, was absolutely forbidden to enter the Chinese areas of the city, and as far as I know, Akira's parents were no less strict on the matter. Out there, we were told, lay all manner of ghastly diseases, filth, and evil men. The closest I had ever come to going out of the settlement was once when a carriage carrying my mother and me took an unexpected route along that part of the Suchao Creek bordering the Chape district. I could see the huddled low rooftops across the canal and had held my breath for as long as I could for fear the pestilence would come airborne across the narrow strip of water. No wonder then that my friends claim to have undertaken a number of secret forays into such areas made an impression on me. I remember quizzing Akira repeatedly about these exploits. The truth concerning the Chinese districts, he told me, was far worse even than the rumors. There were no proper buildings, just shack upon shack, built in great proximity to one another. It all looked, he claimed, much like the marketplace in Boon Road, except that whole families were to be found living in each stall. There were, moreover, dead bodies piled up everywhere, flies buzzing all over them, and no one there thought anything of it. On one occasion, Akira had been strolling down a crowded alley and had seen a man, some powerful warlord, he supposed, being transported on a sedan chair, accompanied by a giant carrying a sword. The warlord was pointing to whomever he pleased, and the giant would then proceed to lop his or her head off. Naturally, people were trying to hide themselves the best they could. Akira, though, had simply stood there, staring defiantly back at the warlord. The latter had spent a moment considering whether to have Akira beheaded, but then, obviously struck by my friend's courage, had finally laughed and, reaching down, patted him on the head. Then the warlord's party had continued on its way, leaving many more severed heads in its wake. I cannot remember ever attempting to challenge Akira on any of these claims. Once I mentioned casually to my mother something about my friend's adventures beyond the settlement, and I remember her smiling and saying something to cast doubt on the matter. I was furious at her, and thereafter I believe I carefully avoided revealing to her anything at all intimate concerning Akira.
Kazuo Ishiguro, reading from When We Were Orphans. Now, it seems, at least for a moment, that Akira is giving, in fact, an accurate portrayal, the bodies, the flies, followed by his childhood fears, a giant, a sword, lopped heads, that somehow or other the jump between truth and fictional projection is minute and is immediately followed upon by the child's desire to disbelieve his friend because of inherent aggressiveness, then to disbelieve his mother when his mother tells him that his friend's stories are untrue. And so what we keep getting is a kind of relativizing of truth and fiction, which leaves no truth and no fiction in a certain way, or no distinguishing between them, which is what I find such a both thrilling and terrifying quality in this novel.
Yeah, of course, I mean, that moment I just read out there, it captures these boys kind of gradually, they're at that kind of stage where they're just about moving out of a childhood world and starting to demand some of the criteria of the adult world in ascertaining what's real and what's not. But they're kind of not quite there yet. And so throughout those childhood passages, that those boys they're very confused about to what extent to indulge in fantasies and to what extent they demand that things are convincing in an adult sense. And here, this description of what life might be like outside of the safe boundaries of the settlement, of course, yes, it embodies the fears of what the outside adult world might be like. But of course, there's also that sense of adventure, of wanting to go out there and thinking, when I get out there, I'll be able to cope with it. It's enticing as well. And here, you know, there's a safety of knowing for these boys at the moment, they think they don't really have to go out there. You know, there won't come a time when they're thrown out there, outside of these boundaries. And to a large extent, this, you know, this is, for me, is at the heart of this book. It's about the painful journey that we all had to make, I guess. In what? Some of us less painful than others, perhaps. But we all had to make some kind of journey out of that protected, sheltered bubble of childhood into the world that we live in now. When you're a child, adults go to great lengths to make you believe that the world is a beautiful, sunlit place without horrible things. But of course, at some point, we come out of that little charmed world. And to some people, for some people, they make that journey in a traumatic way, as Christopher does. His parents disappear. He's bang, he's thrown out of that world. And a part of him is forever trying to go back to that charmed world again. The rest, you know, some others of us may have made that transition in a less violent manner, but maybe we all of us, to some extent, carry at least a sense of disappointment at finding the world to be not quite the beautiful, harmonious place adults, our parents, whoever, you know, wanted us to believe when we were small.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and today we're showcasing excerpts from 25 years of Bookworm conversations with Nobel Prize laureate Kazuo Ishiguro. We'll be back after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
This is Michael Silverblatt. Today on Bookworm, we're hearing excerpts of conversations with the 2017 Nobel laureate Kazuo Ishiguro. In 2005, I spoke with him about his novel Never Let Me Go. Although it takes place in England in the late 1990s, it has a dystopian science fiction dimension. Children who are clones are being educated at a boarding school. They will eventually be used as organ donors.
These are, in a sense, children who've been given special treatment. They've been sent to a special school where the teachers are concerned to give them poetry, novels, have them do art. There's a sports pavilion, there's attractive grounds, there are places for their privacy. And as we read on, we realize that there are enormous numbers of other children who have not gotten to go to one of the special schools. They've simply been bred to harvest. These are special children. They've been given a special program. Shall we allow these clones to be exposed to the human concerns of art? Mm. But all the other such have been raised without it. And it sort of brings to mind the world in which we're living, in which all sorts of people think that this is icing on the cake, the liberal arts, that we can live without them, and that we can breed our underclasses to be unexposed and just expect them to exist without the things that we know make life rich.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting analogy. I hadn't directly applied it to what you just said, but I think it's a correct analogy, and I think it's a very interesting one. After they leave this establishment, the kids ask this question: Why did they make us do all this? And they realize that they have a limited lifespan. You know, that they're bred for organ donation. They don't expect to live much beyond their late 20s. So why did they spend so much of their time and energy being encouraged to create art? And they speculate about this. And I guess if there's a mystery element in the book, a lot of it is about that. I mean, the kids have various theories as to why art was given this value.
In fact, what seems so mysterious about the book is that they don't ask, why was I born? Why did they make me just to kill me? They ask, why are we doing art? It seems like the topsy-turvy version of the question that they would ordinarily ask. Why create a conscious being only to destroy that being through four donations, after which they're said to be completed, although monstrously they may be conscious still, and still giving donations after they've been officially completed?
Well, I mean, that same... I mean, I don't believe in God, but if there was a God, you might well ask more or less the same question to God about how he's built us.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so why, you know, since we're all basically, we've been created to only live at most, you know, 80, 90 years, unless something comes and cuts us down earlier than that. So what is the point? You know, why do we, not just art, but why, you know, why do we work? Why do we have a moral consciousness? Why do we worry about our relationships and seeking love and being loved if we're just all going to just crumble into dust anyway? I mean, who devised this? Why were we created just to die again?
So just all that's happened here in this story is I've used this dystopian outline to compress what for me is a normal lifespan into a peculiarly shortened one. But all the questions I wanted these young people to ask are the questions that we all ask, and all the questions that they push to the back of their minds, like those ones that you just said, you know. So why have we been created? What, you know, should we rebel? They're the same questions I think that we push to the back of our minds. You know, we know we're mortal, but we don't spend all our time morbidly dwelling on that fact. We involve ourselves in the minutiae of our little lives. We even entertain myths about how we can ward off death through art or through finding true love, just as these kids do.
That was Kazuo Ishiguro discussing his novel Never Let Me Go. I spoke with him about his fantasy novel Buried Giant in 2015. Now, Kazuo, what was the inception of The Buried Giant?
Well, this might seem rather strange, but it wasn't Arthurian legends. You know, it wasn't kind of anything to do with that kind of stuff. It was probably the disintegration of Yugoslavia on the doorstep of where I live in Europe, and shortly afterwards, the Rwandan genocide. Both of those events got me thinking about the role of societal memory in conflict situations. In Bosnia, what seemed to have happened was that these people had been living in, or maybe uneasy peace, but you know, these two, at least two or three ethnic groups had been living, coexisting pretty peacefully for at least a generation. They were using each other as babysitters, living in the same villages. And then somehow, very suddenly, perhaps as a result of cynical manipulation by people in power, one group remembered, in quotes, you know, terrible things that the other group had done to them a generation back during the Second World War and beyond, you know, further back, and turned with almost unbelievable viciousness. So I think it was around then I started to think a lot about wanting to write a novel about how communities or nations remembered and forgot, how sometimes they managed to bury certain kinds of dark memories, how sometimes those dark memories came back to life, sometimes deliberately, you know, brought back to life. But that question, when is it better to remember, when is it better to forget, was one of the questions that I became very interested in. It's a question I've always been interested in, you know, at the individual level. I wanted to ask it at the level of a society.
What years in British history are we talking about approximately?
This is approximate, but we're talking about, we're about 490 AD. The Romans leave Britain in 410. The people called the Anglo-Saxons very loosely, the people settling, they're the immigrants coming over from the European mainland, are settling all over Britain and becoming ever more powerful and numerous. The indigenous people who were left behind after the Romans, people I call the Britons, some people call them the Celts or the Romano Celts, for some time fought a kind of rear guard action against the people who are settling. But there does seem to be in a period of uneasy coexistence. And I'm positing that perhaps this period of uneasy coexistence that went on for perhaps a generation or so was created by force. And I guess in this story, yes, I mean, I have created a slightly kind of fantasy version of that time.
Everywhere I look, when they talk to you, you say, I started to write this book and then my wife told me it was not good. So I wrote it again and then my wife said maybe. It seemed to me to be a book born out of a partnership and a complete trust whether the creative aspects of that partnership would outlast this book, that somehow or other this book is about love or is born out of love or is refuted by love, whatever it is. It's an extraordinary thing to do.
I just happened to blurt this out once at a festival about 6 months ago. And then for some reason, you know, Every interview I have done, the person just wants to hear about it again. I think my wife is getting a little bit tired of hearing. She thinks she's been cast as Lady Macbeth or something in this whole story. But it's quite interesting to know why people are so fascinated by this one casual anecdote I happen to come up with spontaneously. But it's
because
the one thing everybody wants to know about.
Anything that's been threatened in our time, we expect nations to be threatened. We expect borderlines to be threatened. We expect religious faith to be threatened. Love is the one thing we want to see left standing. It's sort of like if an author speaks about it directly, of course we're all going to jump down that rabbit hole. We want to hear about the safety and sanctity of love. Oh, tell us a story about love-ish. Tell us that this story outlasts the death of anything but love.
Well, that's good. The title of my last novel, Never Let Me Go, to some extent, it could be applied to this book as well. I mean, I think that phrase, never let me go, which isn't a phrase that I invented, it happens to be the title of a jazz standard, you know, but it always appealed to me and to some extent goes to the heart of the kind of books I've been writing recently, because that request, never let me go, is unreasonable. It's impossible. You can ask someone to keep hold of you for a long time. You know, that's okay. That's achievable. Once you say never let me go, you're asking for the impossible. You're saying at once, you know, I don't ever want to lose you. But you kind of acknowledge that it's impossible, because it can never be granted, that request, never let me go. Something is sooner or later going to come and separate you. And I think in that plea, there's an acknowledgement of the impossibility of the plea itself. And probably at the heart of The Buried Giant and the relationship between the couple, I mean, they too, you know, want to say, never let me go, but they understand that that's actually an impossible request.
That was Nobel laureate Kazuo Ishiguro discussing his novel Buried Giant. Today we've been hearing excerpts from 25 years of Bookworm conversations with him. We also heard him discuss his novels Remains of the Day, When We Were Orphans, and Never Let Me Go. They're all published by Vintage.
Hear him speak about his new novel, Clara and the Sun, next week.
Thank you for joining me. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Sean Sullivan and to Alan Howard for putting together this special show. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.